Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Peter Mayo.
Thank you.
Professor Mayo is a professor, obviously, in the Department of Education Studies within the university's Faculty of Education, formerly a school teacher and officer in charge of adult education, the Education Department. He has been active in social theory, sociology of education, comparative education, adult education, and critical sociology of higher education. Professor Mayo has won 3 international awards, American Education Studies Association Critics' Choice Award for the book Freire Liberating Praxis, another award for a book with Leona English called Learning with Adults, a Critical Pedagogical Introduction, and another one for a published paper on higher education from a comparative and international perspective. He has published over 120 papers, either in chapters in books or in papers in referee journals, a number of the latter in Social Science Citation Index journals, and around 20 books, 12 of them authored. The journals he's written in include Cultural Studies, Critical Methodologies, Globalization, Societies and Education, Studies in Philosophy and Education, British Journal of Sociology of Education, and several others. His books include Gramsci, Freire and Adult Education, Learning and Social Difference, Learning with Adults, A Critical Pedagogical Introduction, Politics of Indignation, and Lorenzo Milani, The School of Barbiana and the Struggle for Social Justice. That was in 2013. Professor Mayo has contributed journalistic pieces to Counterpunch, Truth Out, Gramsci Oggi, and to Gianni Minà's periodical Latino America, E Tutti Sud del Mondo, besides also Novosti, a Croatian journal, and Sol from Turkey. His forthcoming book, published by Routledge, is entitled Hegemony and Education Under Neoliberalism, Insights from Gramsci, and this is due out in April or May. Welcome, Professor Mayo.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
I suppose that we should start off by talking a little bit about Gramsci. You've spent much of your career,
I say a quarter of a century,
discussing Gramsci, researching Gramsci, and also Paulo Freire, of course, another important figure who, despite the time gap between them, shared similar approaches with regard to critical pedagogy and popular education. Tell us what it is in these figures that has kept your interest for a quarter of a century and your academic attention. What is it about them that fascinates you?
First of all, you know, I have to say that I've written about other things, not just them. And one of the figures, Lorenzo Milani, I've written about ever since I've been moved by a film I saw. Actually, I saw that in 1989 and it really captured my attention. But I've been working in other various projects. I've got the book, working on a book on Palestine, based on a project we carried out with Palestinian colleagues inside Palestine itself. And I'm doing a book on higher education for Manchester University Press. So, you know, my interests are much more broader than simply these figures. But yes, Gramsci and Freire loom large. I would say particularly Gramsci, because I always find in his copious notes and some of which take on the form of essays, new insights, and I think a lifetime of work is not even enough to cover what is relevant to education, viewed, as I always do, in the broadest sense. I do not limit myself to just schooling or institutional adult education, although that's important. But as you know, and some of my friends know who might be listening to this program, I view education in a broader sense. Now, that also includes consciousness raising and learning through action at the grassroots level. And what I find interesting, particularly from Gramsci, is his notion of power, his conceptualization of power, and so, and how some of his insights, which he wrote, I mean, he died in 1937, so the first part of the previous century, become very relevant even today. First of all, because I don't think his critique was the cap. What he tries to provide is someone like Marx, whose grave I visited yesterday. Strangely enough, I just happened to be in the area working on a project with Pluto Press, and basically I was saying even yesterday, I said, you know, how relevant he is today. The kind of situation we're living in, where people are still living in a precarious life, which has always been the staple of vulnerable, I would say, majority of the world. Some of the conditions, okay, the context will change, but in the sense of precariousness, they probably didn't use the word precarious then, is around us. All you have to do is just go into a pizza parlor anywhere, particularly in the big cities, but even here in Malta, and just look at the mechanistic features of people being involved, you know, production on for nothing, for a pittance, basically, and you can see Fordism, which is the kind of Taylorist mode of production from taken from outside the factory into the services area. So that is just to give you one example, a graphic example. I remember sitting in a pizza place in Milan, and I was just looking at the antics of the person actually distributing the pizza, getting it out of the oven, giving it to people, and it looked like he's being on the production line. And I just looked at him, and when I see Dario Fo's enactment of Brecht, I remember this incident. This reenactment of Brecht was an insert in a document produced by a late friend of mine, Giorgio Baratta, on Gramsci's relevance today. So, you know, like, it's very easy to dismiss certain social theorists as being passé, but I think basically, okay, some of the concepts have to be reinvented because times change, but the essential factor of the exploitative nature of capitalist production, and I'm going to use the word capitalism, it remains. It may take on different forms, but then when you look deeply, you'll find the same kind of social relation occurring. So I find that very relevant. The other thing which really attracted me to Gramsci, and from the very beginning, I was a graduate student at the University of Alberta in Canada. Now, anybody who knows anything about Canada knows that Alberta is known as a redneck province. It's the most conservative province in Canada. But I happen to be exposed to some really fine scholars, some of whom eventually moved elsewhere. People like Carlos Torres, people like Raymond Morrow, people like Derek Sayer, who's now retiring from England, from Lancaster, who's written brilliant books, etc., etc. So I was exposed to social theory, and I was attracted to the works of Marx, whose excerpts from whom we studied, and Max Weber, as classical sociology, I'm talking about other writers. And when I was asked to write my paper, we didn't tackle Gramsci in our course, which dealt with Marx and Weber, and I saw his name, and it somehow resonated with my own experience coming from Southern Europe. And of course, of all the theories and all the writings that we have from Gramsci, the one, and I say this in my forthcoming book, the one which really attracted me to his oeuvre is his writings on the Southern question, La Questione, archaic Italian, Questione today, La Questione Meridionale. I identified with that piece. And I'm sure that my good friend Joseph Buttigieg, who is one of the leading authorities on Gramsci in the United States, with whom I've collaborated and forged a great friendship, probably feels, he feels the same way. He feels the same way. It's basic, and also colleagues like Carmel Borch, we respond to that kind of situation because it speaks to our own experience as somebody coming from what has been constructed, quote-unquote, as a peripheral country on the periphery of Europe. This was a term used by the Council of Europe, by the way, to designate places like Malta and even Portugal. So it's not just small countries, even countries who once had an empire. We who come from the periphery or semi-periphery as a go-between the central countries and the others in Boaventura de Sousa, Santos there, we resonate with that experience. The kind of situation that Gramsci describes when he talks about southern Italy, you can easily, historically, connect with Malta. When he talks about the traditional intellectuals, when he talks about who are these traditional intellectuals, not the grandees, but the subaltern ones, your teacher, your notaio, your notary public, your priests, etc., and the impact on the community, and the connections with land, etc. You can read Maltese history that way. And the impact of the failed Neapolitan Revolution, the Partenopean Revolution, and how it connects also with the reaction here in Malta against the French, there's lots and lots of similarities. In fact, there's one Maltese author, Mario Vella, who wrote a book called Reflections on the Canvasback. And in his last chapter, he makes connections between these things I've been saying. So, to give credit to where it's due, there are many other people who have done work on this, even locally. What I'm trying to say, we do have some, a very small, but some literature, interesting literature on the subject. I think there's a mouthful in Gramsci for anybody even wanting to read history against the grain. I'm talking about Maltese history. I'm sure people like John Kirkop do that, for instance, because he has the theoretical preparation to do that, but doesn't have to, you know, I'm not saying this is a closure. I mean, there are people who write history who come from different backgrounds, but, you know, John Kirkop is one person who comes to mind. So, why am I attracted? And with Paulo Freire, I have to say, okay, Gramsci gives you the more expansive theory. With Paulo Freire, then, the pedagogical approach of Paulo Freire reflects some of the concerns expressed by Gramsci, but I would say also other writers, or he might have influenced people who came later. I mean, people like Edward Said, for instance, you know. I found a connection, a pedagogical connection, to the kind of sociological analysis that I was deriving from people from the South. I consider Gramsci to be from the south, even though he's from Sardinia, but, you know, like, it's an island, you know, it's one of the islands, as opposed to the continente. And certainly people like Said, Ibrahim Aboulod, and all the others. So, with Paulo Freire, you have a person coming from the south, a person coming from Brazil. We had heard a lot about Paulo Freire in Malta, especially through Kenneth Wayne. Kenneth Wayne has been a pioneer in many respects in this kind of thinking. I even heard about Gramsci from others, and even from Kenneth Wayne in courses taught in 1980. To give credit where it's due, Professor Kenneth Wayne has been an influence on many of us here. And I say many of us, both in philosophy and in education. Just to give him credit, he introduced us, my good friend Carmen Dalli from New Zealand reminded me of a course we once took from him called The Concept of the Educated Man. Now today he would not use the word man, of course. There'll be a lynch mob for him if he does that. And Gramsci was mentioned there. He was talking about the organic intellectuals. So we had some exposure. The whole idea, even Paulo Freire was mentioned in one of these courses. These became very intriguing figures who I wanted to explore later, because my interest at the time was English literature. And when I finished my B.Ed. course, I did an honors degree from University of London in English. So I was reading literary stuff. And I didn't get much into literary theory, unfortunately. Then I moved into sociology, and I don't regret that move. I started reading further those things to which I was exposed as an undergraduate. And, you know, it's like the circle becomes complete. Well, it never becomes complete, but
one hopes not, though.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know if I've answered
absolutely. In fact, I was going to quote Joseph Buttigieg. You mentioned that he wrote the preface to your new book, because he says that perhaps one of the reasons why Gramsci has managed to sustain interest over the years is because he was not dogmatic about his thoughts, or
neither was Marx, by the way,
and his approach to political thought was not limited. He had a sort of heterodoxy, you know. He wasn't perhaps that's why he's lasted so long.
Yeah, first of all, I would say, I don't know if you picked that up when you were asking the question, so was Marx. You know, it's particular readings and distortions of Marx which I think have really it was just a problem. Yeah, Gramsci, it's well known, it's a standard statement about Gramsci, but one has to be careful too. When we're dealing with Gramsci, we're dealing with fragments, you know. But it's true, I mean, Gramsci has an open reading of Marxism, which made him very interesting to people from various parts of the world. In the 60s and 70s, he was a revelation for Latin America. And, you know, Gramsci is big all over the world except in Italy. But particularly, honestly, you know, you get much Gramsci outside Italy than inside Italy and Sardinia itself. And I've experienced this personally. But Latin America was very much the left in Latin America, especially during the time of totalitarian regimes, but even before, was very much taken over by Gramsci. And because what you have in Gramsci is a... doesn't mean that you don't have that in Marx, of course. There's always a contextualization of ideas. As with Marx, the worst thing which can happen in any kind of orientation is when you pick out contexts, decontextualize them, and then they become abstract. That's violence. That's theoretical violence, I call that. I mean, Derek Sayre, former teacher of mine, wrote a book called The Violence of Abstraction, which deals with this issue, amongst others. And people in Latin America were looking at Gramsci as providing a much more, how shall I say, relevant reading of power than the kind of dogmatic, orthodox, vulgar, if you like, Marxism, which was being promoted by certain communist parties in Brazil, for instance. I don't know about other places. And which did not capture people's imagination. Whereas Gramsci had a great impact on various fields in Latin America, in political renewal fields, like, you know, the Partito Trabajadores in its very beginning, the Workers' Party. He had a great influence about the new left throughout Latin America. He had a great influence on liberation theology, for example, amongst work, and this is where Freire comes in, amongst work by popular educators who were being conceived of as organic intellectuals, an intellectual connected to a particular movement, a particular moment in time, and also connected to a particular social class or ethnic group. So he had a great connection in this respect with popular educators working in the Christian-based communities in Latin America. And even today, with your Occupy movements, grassroots movement, the Indignados, etc., Gramsci's notion of power has a great, great impact. Not alone. I mean, I would say today you have people like, certainly people like Laclau, which is in the Greek case, particularly, where some of the most important figures in the Syriza party were students of Ernesto Laclau at Essex. But apart from Laclau and other authors, Gramsci has a great impact because of the whole concept of hegemony and the whole concept of how hegemony can always be transformed gradually within its own interstices. It's not a binary. It's not like, okay, have hegemony, therefore we have counter-hegemony. There's no such thing as... Gramsci never used the word counter-hegemony. It's a point I make in my book. You can look anywhere in Gramsci. We never find that word because it sets up a binary, and that's the relationship is... Well, he's a Marxist, so the relationship would be dialectical. This is the problem that... when we start separating binaries, and we don't need postmodernists to tell us this, because even, you know, a lot of social theory, classical social theory, particularly social theory from people like Marx, Gramsci, you know, within the historical materialist tradition, ergo, Marxism, has always spoken about dialectical relationship, internal relationship between things, which you find in Paulo Freire, by the way. His major book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, reflects in the first three chapters, I won't say the fourth one, but the first three chapters, that should have been a book on its own. Those first three chapters are a brilliant rendering of the dialectical relationship between things.
In the 1989, the crumbling of communism, and you had the democratic reaction sort of shaking the foundations of socialism and communism, and then the development of neoliberalism, which you attack so strongly in your book.
Neoliberalism started before. It obviously became much more widespread, but it started before. It started with the Chilean. That's something I wrote about in my book, Politics of Indignation, which is based on articles published in Counterpunch and Truth Out. And that started with the Chilean coup d'etat of Augusto Pinochet against a democratically elected government, which was nationalizing all kinds of services and important products, resources like copper, also backed by the multinationals. That was a trial run for neoliberalism. Neoliberalism had its origins in an orgy of bloodshed. In 1980, had the same thing in Turkey, with the coup d'etat in Turkey. Yes, I know. Marxism was prima facie, because most people wouldn't know what Marxism is. They, you know, they associate with Soviet communism, the legacy of Stalin, etc., etc. Okay, yeah, I mean that was vilified, that was discredited, and indeed it is. You know, probably Marx himself would have might have agreed with us if one goes along with, and I tend to agree with him here, with Terry Eagleton, why Marx was right. He probably would have argued, of course, there was no way it could succeed if it was not backed by a revolution where the wealth in Western Europe, like Germany, for instance, where you had the concentration of wealth. Because what Marx had in mind, it was a revolution, a socialist distribution of resources and control over resources in a context where you have an accumulation of wealth. And Europe had that accumulation of wealth. It happened in the wrong place. It could have succeeded if it was followed by a revolution in Germany. So I don't think it would have taken Marx by surprise.
But if you have this neoliberalism, which has reached the stage where it's becoming quite obvious that there is the gap between the poor and the very wealthy is widening and has perhaps created the two extremes of the political spectrum.
1% and 99%, yes.
Uh-huh. So where can Gramscian idea fit in to today's world?
Okay, if I had the answer to that, I would have the solution of the world's problems, which I don't have, and I don't think anybody has.
What a pity.
And I think, and I don't think anybody will. Maybe when I get the brainwave, I'll die the moment I get that. No, but the thing is, Gramsci and others, not just Gramsci, I mean, Gramsci is just one person I happen to be specializing in, okay, can give us tools, help us develop tools to make theoretical sense out of the kind of activism, the kind of organization, which always has taken place historically. Always has taken place historically. But now we have a particular kind of, we're looking at a lot of pockets all over the world. Occupy movement, the indignados, the original Arab I don't call it a spring, uprising, but of course which went in different directions, you know, and they didn't hit the heart of the matter, which was like the army, for example, etc., 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 Gezi Park revolt in Turkey, etc. It's how to make theoretical sense out of that, and therefore bring in, raise questions, probably much more easy to raise questions than to provide answers, problematize, that is, in Freire's terms, issues like, is there any conscious direction to the spontaneity? Gramsci talks about spontaneità e direzione consapevole, spontaneity and conscious direction. And if so, where is it coming from? The reactions can take different routes, different trajectories. They don't have to be particularly democratic trajectories. I mean, the situation in Greece was calling out for a right-wing coup d'etat. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, like, where's the direction coming from? Who's providing a modicum of organized? You always need organization. But we're going through a stage where I think Gramsci is very interesting because we have all these reactions against a system which we know it's false, but for which we don't have answers. What I'm trying to say is this. Basically, what we have, neoliberalism, there's been always research about neoliberalism, leaves everything to the market. The market cannot safeguard people's lives. This is one of the biggest myths. You know, the invisible hand will not safeguard people's lives. Not surprisingly, we have seen a tremendous problems with regard to access to health, where, you know, like, everything in the budgetary concern is always favoring big capital. We have seen spiraling graphs, and there's a lot of books about this, writing about it, in terms of health problems. We only individualize those health problems. We say these are chemical distortions in the mind. Well and good. I could suffer for something, and I would say, yes, it is. But we never hear about the structuring forces at play, which conditions that kind of situation, which actually, I wouldn't say determine, maybe in the last instance, but conditions those kind of situations. And this is the sense of, how should I put it, uncertainty that people live with, the sense of clinging to something, you know, just hanging on to something. And that's the reality of most lives, you know. So it's a terrible situation. It is barbarism. It is barbarism, Rosa Luxemburg's terms. And what's the alternative to this? Now, where Gramsci comes in, I think Gramsci and others, not just Gramsci, can give us insights and to provide a coherent approach. Now, whether we will come up with an answer, I don't think we have come up with I don't think the left, in particular, has come up with an answer. It's been very good at unmasking it, criticizing, but we have not come up with an alternative. What has happened, unfortunately, and I see this also in Malta, is people who historically were supposed to represent the left in Malta, took on what is, and not just Malta, globally.
I was going to say,
globally, Tony Blair is a classic example of it. It's, you know, like, if you can't beat them, join them. Or rather, they have succumbed to what is now being refined, following Mark Fisher and others, as capitalist realism. But what I'm trying to say, people know that neoliberalism is not delivering, but they don't have an answer to it.
But the shape of the kind of lives people live now, with things, I might sound banal, with social media, with kind of technology that we're living with now, the kind of direction we're going in, those, the formations, political formations are changing.
Of course, yes.
And it's going to be very difficult trying to join up the points here and try and find a way.
But
I mean, IS couldn't have been created without social media.
Yes.
So if something like IS can be created, perhaps something better
all,
can be created as well.
That can also bring us back to the issue of hegemony. I read a paper recently, which is about to be published, which talks about the kind of knowledge that people need to be able to count, you know, like to operate in what he calls a post-hegemonic society. I have problems with that. Now, he's referring to the software as a form of a shaping element. I see nothing post-hegemonic about that. I see that as very hegemonic. In fact, yes. And so he talks about what's powerful knowledge. And powerful knowledge, he didn't use the word powerful knowledge. Powerful knowledge is a term which Mary Darmanin introduced me to via a person who became a good friend of mine, Michael Young. He includes a very important element, and that's coding. How people should learn how to code and decode, etc. That's important. But, you know, like, hegemony can move different ways. So what's so interesting about hegemony, it's an open concept. It's not just critique, it's also renewal, it's reinventing. That's a concept which Gramsci elaborated from the old classical notion of hegemon, of leadership. It was used also in communist discourse, gegemonia. It's a Greek word, of course, but it was used in Russia and also used in linguistics, to which he was exposed as a student. Gramsci was. Philology, right? But, you know, that's an open thing. It contains, as I said before, within it, the spaces which one fights. Now, you can say social media constitutes one of those spaces. It can go either way. So it's who's being organized and how it's being used, etc., etc. So it can go either way. But it's social media, software, etc., they are part of the spaces within the hegemonic structure in which one renegotiates relations, because it's all about relations, of hegemony.
That, I'm afraid, we're going to have to...
Are we going to unravel that?
I don't think so, not in the 28 minutes that we have.
Yeah, we need a program for me to explain that.
Absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. Well, perhaps we will have another one. Thank you very, very much, Professor Peter Mayo.
Well, thanks, it's a pleasure.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.